Hello, everybody. Welcome to this new episode of CCYSEC AVAS. I'm Sayan Demirol, and I'm here with Cemile Rodriguez.
Hi, everyone.
We met and recorded our first episode together with Bayce Vucic, who is a PhD researcher in UCL and an expert in Janusz Korczak's educational philosophy. In our previous conversation, Bayce drew us an interesting framework about how the field of education and child-centered methods could have the roots in evolutionary theory, and what kind of connections lay behind under criminology and the relationship between criminology and education. While considering the nature of the child, Bayce Vucic showed us the unknown aspects of the Montessori method. And let me say that our way of thinking has already changed. So today, we will touch upon the nature of education with another interesting topic, which Bayce invented for us, educating the educator. And the topic is quite interesting for me, and I'm very curious about what Bayce would tell us today. And I'm quite excited to hear some mind-opening ideas by criticizing the arguments and developing new perspectives throughout the experiences of Janusz Korczak.
So, Bayce, while we were discussing the rational nature of the child because of their being human beings, for sure, you underline the tension between intuition and intellect, or let me ask it, I'm right to define their relationship as attention. How would you define that?
Okay, well, how about we start with thinking about intuition in your life. Jamila, how would you describe intuition?
I felt it, and I had a feeling about something. I had a premonition, or I just knew how. Like I took a leap of faith. I'm not okay. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So rotates around the idea of guessing, I suppose, of not knowing.
Yes, of not knowing rationally.
Yes, yeah, it came to my mind, but I don't know why. I feel like that. But it's like a part of intellect, I think. Or let's say they are like two faces of the coin, intuition and intellect. They seem the opposite, but also they exist by the other's existence. I can make a definition like that. Intuition may be the way of thinking without thinking. Maybe if you improve your intuition or learn to listen to it, learn to how to use it, and then maybe you find a way to control, like controlling your mind, and maybe you can find out the reasons of why you feel like that.
Adults often come up with those sort of explanations, but we deny it to children. And so what we do is we're quashing it, that capacity, as we get older. And then we talk about having to rebuild it because we become unable to make decisions unless we already know the right answer. We actually often become afraid of not knowing and not having that answer intellectually. So we were talking about human nature. And if we go back to that, there's this philosophical idea that instead of saying that we are good or bad, or decisions are good or bad, I suppose, instead that we can say that we are both changeable and unchangeable. Now, how can that be? Right, so the idea behind that is that there is a true human nature, which is universal, something we all share, something that connects us through that idea of the collective soul. And we share those things in common. And then there are these individual aspects which are actually artificial. Those are to do with our material circumstances, our cultural history, and that those parts can actually be changed. So underlying that is this universal nature of humanity. And the sorts of elements that we would talk about in this universal nature is the ability to think, that social drive that we've talked about in the last episode, you know, that idea, the desire to interact, the ability to communicate. Humans have the capacity to form communities. We're a social animal, okay? And then we can have those other elements, which are perhaps just a little bit harder to pin down, okay? They're a bit more emotional. They're a bit more spiritual, I suppose. And we have this capacity for love, drive for freedom, we have a sense of justice, and that really interesting one, which is creativity. We can actually imagine something different. Now, if you look at all of those elements that I was just talking about, the ability to think is an intellectual capacity, but all of those others, they're not in that same domain, right? It's really difficult to rationalize and delineate them intellectually. So we end up talking about feeling free or having a sense of justice. And then love, well, the academics, they avoid the subject of love, right? And that doesn't mean, of course, that it doesn't exist or it's not important. It's just not in that intellectual domain. So all of these other things are falling under intuition. So intuition is not just the opposite of intellect. But like you said, Saran, I really like that description that you gave us of two sides of the same coin. They're supposed to be inseparable and in harmony. And when you focus on just intellectual development of reason, on just that one-sidedness, you lose the richness from those questions on love and creativity and justice. And it starts making our debates really linear and lopsided, and that decision making becomes one-sided and usually in the favor of those who already hold the power. And that's because their worldview already exists, so it must be the most rational one, right? It's the easiest to defend intellectually. So with our pedagogy, we're trying to turn away from those dogmatic ideas of obedience to authorities without those extra questions. So that's against both science and religion, both the dogmatic ideas that you find in science and religion. And we're going back to those shared ideas that are universal, that connectivity, the interdependence between people and nature. And we're going to go much further than just the here and now, okay? Because it's about our ancestors before us, and it's those who are coming after. So we're that one moment that links the past, the present, and the future together.
So, Basha, this pedagogy integrates intuition and intellect, and what about the relationship between childish thinking and rationality?
Yeah, exactly. So in children, even though we just described ourselves using intuition all the time, we tend to mock intuition. We say, oh, they're being silly. We expect children to tell the truth. We want them to explain themselves rationally and logically, as if that's really simple for us to do, right? So, you know, as adults, we do it all the time. We take guesses, we play with scenarios, we imagine other ways, and we visualize. Now, many of the times, many of those terms we're now finding in contemporary psychology, but the early psychologists were actually fighting against this. They were trying to present this new discipline as a rational laboratory science. So we're at the point of tying it all back together. And hopefully I can show you how that relates to our evolutionary theory that we were discussing of the born criminal last time. So remember that we talked about leading the primitive man, that savage within us, through the stages of civilization and how that was thought to be related to children's development, right? So here we have a hierarchy where they were putting scientific thinking as better than religious thinking. And then that was, of course, better and over the top of magical thinking at the bottom, which is where we often place the children. Like you said, that childish thinking, they believe in magic like fairies and Father Christmas. But now research is showing us, we're finding out that all three types of thinking are complementary and possibly necessary for creativity and those other aspects of intuition. So instead of the development of cognitive thought, we've got to think about this development of metaphysical thought. Now, we don't have any comprehensive theories that can help us examine these processes through childhood into adulthood, but we do have research that shows us that children are sensitive to how different cultures discuss those kind of difficult concepts like truth and reality. So if we look at it from a psychological perspective like Piaget, he thought that developmentally children are artificialists, right? So what that means is that he thought they misunderstand all things are created by human power. But instead, research now shows us that children are actually intuitive theists because they view that natural phenomena is intentionally designed by a god. Now, not coincidentally, they also view natural objects as existing for a purpose. Now, all folk religions share this basis of non-natural agents and intentional causation. It's a teleological view of the world. And it's actually really hard to dismiss by calling it, you know, something religious or silly and childish, because it's actually appearing in works by atheist philosophers like Thomas Nagel.
But Basha, I've heard many teachers now talk about similar concepts in terms of wonder and curiosity, especially in terms of play, children's playing. They are not talking about spiritual things. So why do you think we need something more?
So I suppose I'll tell you a story about a young child that I knew in the context of play and this idea of curiosity and wonder. So he's in a group using clay. And they're molding it, pounding it, they're rolling the clay, and the teacher's making observations and comments about the different developmental stages and scientific exploration of each child's play. So this boy, when he saw someone roll it in their fingers, he jumped up and he tried to go out into the garden. And the teacher stopped him because she says, no, come back, we're all playing with clay. And she's thinking that he's unable to focus on the activity. Now, he becomes quite, you know, agitated. He becomes quite angry, actually. And he tries to drag the teacher outside and some of the other children outside into the garden. Now, eventually, she just has to let him go. He's so upset. And the group of children follow him. And he got a little shovel and he dug a little hole in the garden. And he took out some of the dirt and he rolled it in his fingers. And the soil came together because it contained clay particles. Now, this boy was 2 years old and he didn't really speak any words. But that day he spoke volumes, right, in another way, not verbally. And this boy had done lots of gardening with his grandfather. And that the grandfather had shown him how to tell the difference between soil types, that sandy soil falls through your fingers. And the greater the clay content, the soil binds together. Now, we can see from this example that the two-year-old knew something more about the physical and chemical properties of that material, some kind of form of cultural knowledge, scientific knowledge, more than the teacher did. And that's what I want to ask you. If you're taking, really taking children seriously while they're at play, and I suppose I want to tell you what Korczak wrote about play, and this is something directly quoting for him. It is playing, you will say, but damn it, can't you see the child's mental effort and determination? You are facing a scientist in his laboratory, engrossed in a problem of single importance, which at the moment escapes his comprehension. A young baby will enforce its will by screaming, and later on it will do by facial expressions. Movements of arms and hands, and finally through speech. Now, we often call little children little scientists and little artists, but how is your knowledge of science? And I mean, what do I really know about art, about tone, about space and color? And are we setting boundaries which actually restrict children's explorations, even though we say we're expanding them with this idea of play and wonder and curiosity and joy? So, for example, when a child is painting, does the teacher ask them, what is it? Or tell me about it. Tell me what you're doing. Are they forcing children into verbal descriptions of something which cannot actually be put into words? So I'll give you another example just to sort of clarify that point. I was involved in an art exhibition that I co-hosted with a group of children. And one of the boys is 3 years old, and he stopped to show his piece of artwork to his mother and his sister. And he'd drawn these two black lines, and they were crossed with horizontal lines, and over the top he'd colored green and blue and purple, and right at the top there was red. Now, the title of the artwork was The Ladder, and the mother said, "Oh, yes, it's a very good ladder. But look at all these scribbles of color. Why did you mess it up like that?" And this little boy got really angry and he stomped his foot and he said with this loud voice, he yelled out, "It's not a ladder. It's how I feel on a ladder."
Wow.
So that's great.
Yes.
So I'm trying to challenge us, right, to think about what we know and what we don't know about art and science and all those other philosophical assumptions that we are making when we bound children's knowledge, you know, in that what we know instead of what we don't know. I suppose, yeah, hopefully that gives you an idea of where we're headed.
That reminds me, sometimes for younger kids, even they are, they feel creative and they are willing to paint, that their painting classes might be challenging for them because of teachers forcing them to do something right, to do something the way it should be. But there's no rational way to do arts. So to make it more in a more creative way, intuition part is more important. Now I'm convinced, and I think I'm beginning to understand what you are trying to tell us. So
yeah, it's a good example because it's very popular right now to do observational drawing, which is that rational sort of scientific style of trying to capture something in a material, natural form without the subjectivity of the viewer. So that's a really good example of where we're forcing children into one particular domain of art, and that's, you know, that observational drawing style, to really ignore all those other ways of exploring art. So that's a really good point.
And I think it's maybe about the traditional ways of education. Maybe in some alternative, let's say, child-centered pedagogies, it can be more different. And last time we discussed the Montessori method, and I've been reading your book. I'm also quite impressed how many famous people actually visited our home. And all those child-centered approaches, some alternative pedagogies came to my mind. But after that, I'm also very impressed by all those famous pedagogists and psychologists visiting our home. And you mentioned about Jean Piaget, was also very inspired by Korshak and the experiments, let's say, experience. And also I can use both words, I think. Maybe you can also explain the relationship between experiments and experience of Korshak. It may be very interesting for us. And I hope you could tell us a little more about these visits, Piaget's, Korshak's influences on Piaget and his way of thinking in psychological approach to childhood and children.
Absolutely, yes. So Korshak did know about the psychological and developmental theories of his time, and he wasn't particularly interested in them. Of course, you know, as a pediatrician, he was aware of the general stages of biological development. He understood patterns of walking and talking and teething, but he warned that these are valid for children in general, rather than applying them specifically to a child. Whereas Piaget took a different path that was popular at the time because he was trying to formulate that universal theory of child development, which has become quite pervasive, really, throughout psychology and indeed education. So what we found with Korshak's visiting Korshak, he actually tried to create those laboratory style experiments out of the things that he saw there and out of what he read, because also one of the things is that Piaget's assistant was a Polish, he had a Polish assistant, so he was able to have Korczak's works translated for him. And some of the time you can actually find correlation between things that Korczak had written, and you can find Piaget trying to create an experiment out of something that Korczak had observed quite spontaneously. So what we see is that Korczak is providing us with this really unique and systematic image of the child, both as an individual, but also in relation to the collective. So he used a holistic lens, and he was conducting his research not in a laboratory, right? But he, we can say out in the world, out in the wild, right? He's observing children in real life situations. And it's quite different to what we find in education today, because Korczak starts primarily with what we can experience, right? With that physical and that emotional. And he says the cognitive development and that internal life, that part will follow. So we could say that his collectivist model is a bit like Vygotsky or what we find in social psychology now, because he explained that if you look at a child that has been separated, right, cut off from the rest of life and rest of group, our view of them is only from one perspective. In each group action, including play, children differ in each detail than doing it for themselves. And then we see who they are in life amongst people, not in these artificial situations that someone like Piaget was creating. Now, the Russians were also influenced. You mentioned famous visitors, and that's right. They were also influenced by Korczak. They translated his books, and they visited the orphanages because they were trying to establish their own education system after the Russian Revolution. But we find that their underpinning philosophy, and of course Vygotsky's, is significantly different than Korczak. The Russians, the communists, wanted their own materialist psychology based upon the teachings of Marx. And that was, they were trying to counter the individualist behaviorism, the behaviorist psychology that was coming out of the West.
Mm. So, Basha, if we want to incorporate this new philosophy, what kind of advice do you think would Korczak would give us?
Well, actually, we're quite lucky because Korczak did give advice to parents, right? So we're actually really lucky that we can read some of his books specifically addressed to parents and to teachers. And he advised parents to spend time with their baby, even when sleeping. You know, it wasn't just race out of the room and don't be with them anymore. He saw that even in that subconscious time, that was really important in our interactions. He said to talk to your infant, even when your infant is pre-verbal and doesn't seem to understand. So very, very small, to involve them gently in everyday life and in decision-making right from the beginning. Now, all of that is actually grounded today in aspects of natural pedagogy and some of the social learning theories. But we've got to remember that learning by communication is exclusively a human thing, right? What he's talking about. And it's universal within all human cultures, all parenting styles, right? So he's actually talking about something that is universally human and not culturally specific to him, to his historical time or his place, right? So it's how Korczak's pedagogy is containing that sort of evolutionary understanding, okay? But he's going a step further because he includes the baby's agency, okay, within this process of social learning. This is how a baby shapes their family, shapes the community and the society around them. And that's where Korczak is reversing the educational process, where the adult is positioned as the one who first needs to be raised, right? It's where the child gives me experience. The child affects my view of the world when I'm around them, right? It changes my feelings, okay? So this idea of educating the educator, he explains that by spending time with the child, the mother, the teacher, any adult can actually mature in inspiration. So rather than forcing the child into some kind of developmental or cultural norms, Korczak advises us that first we should respectfully get to know who the child is as a person.
So this sounds, Korczak's ideas about respectfully getting to know the child is like a very different view of child development. Definitely very different to Piaget and other psychologists. Maybe you could give us more examples about this?
Okay, so I've got some observation notes that Korczak wrote about a baby. Now the baby's playing with a rattle and it's a very small infant just learning to be able to pick up the rattle. And he describes how the baby talks to their own hands and they're waiting for an answer. And the baby is surprised when their hand actually grabs the rattle and the image of the hand changes, right? It becomes a rattle hand. Okay, so he goes into great depth, more than a baby learning this motor control and more than problem solving skills, which is the usual kind of description that we would find within the child development circles. He incorporates a discussion of the infant's emotions and some internal imagery, right? So these are the elements that are immaterial, they're intangible, okay? So with that kind of background, we now see the infant as exploring the spectrum of materiality and their own position within that spectrum between the tangible and the physically intangible. So picking up the rattle changes the material object into this strange image, you know, that rattle hand, it's something new. And the baby holding the rattle is like a primitive man picking up a spear. Okay, it now has new resources at their disposal. There are new possibilities. This changes the baby's capacity for power, for what it can do, what it can achieve. So long before we had postmodernists and physicists talking, you know, explaining to us that matter and energy are essentially the same, this newborn baby is experimenting with the same kind of concepts. And the baby is struggling to differentiate the form and the permanence of the objects, including self, right? They're relying on doing these empirical experiments, these tests on the world around them. And now, look, it's pretty much impossible that I'm going to be able to explain this all in a way that everybody sort of is on board in such a short space of time. But pretty much we're talking about this exploration of self, and of me, and also of possession, of mine, of property, okay? And we're reconciling this consciousness within us and the physical experiments of the body. The baby is asking the question, what is real? So we can see that is really out of Piaget's league, out of his psychological stages. This is really something very philosophical.
Yes, it's quite interesting so far. And, you know, when we talk about natural sciences, questions of what is real have been formed in modern science within the fields of physics, chemistry, biology, like any other scientific areas. And for example, scientists pose questions of how materials behave under different conditions in a laboratory atmosphere and how to choose or modify them to solve a problem or to achieve their goals. But I see that these are also questions of metaphysics and materiality, which philosophers have tried to answer since ancient times. So it sounds like Korczak wanted us to see the child as little scientists. I mean, really, they are like little scientists. And also, there are little philosophers working on these very important questions.
Yeah, exactly. I like children as little philosophers. And children cannot be creative or flourish if we do not allow them to believe or question something that adults cannot see or understand. And if we think about famous scientists that Korczak wrote about, someone like Louis Pasteur, who of course was the father of bacteriology, discovered germs, he had other scientists laughing at him because they could not believe in something invisible, something intangible, something that was not rationally explained by the logic of the time. It was something ahead of rational explanation. Now, we now recognize that that a world that's built just on intellect and rationality and that rational thought actually led us to a very dark time in the world's history with the Holocaust. So hopefully I'm convincing you and you're beginning to see why we need faith and mystery in our pedagogy, rather than saying that everything is rational or can be logically explained. Because if we don't admit by saying that I don't know, then, you know, all we're doing is lying, pretending and deceiving children.
So, Basha, these are very, really interesting ideas. Can you please describe how this might look for a teacher today in our current times? I guess even though there is more room for emotions and intuition in education today compared to Janusz Korczak's times, these ideas still may still sound not that serious, right?
Yeah, well, remember we talked about Montessori describing the role of the objective teacher, and now we've just been talking about Piaget believing he was the objective, you know, researcher of children's development. So what we find here is that need for subjectivity. And even further, we've got Korczak presenting us with this emergentist epistemological theory. Now, I know that's just like a whole lot of big words, but I want you to think about it as adopting a feminist or a minority perspective, right? We're opening up to different experiences and knowledge of a group of people who aren't always heard from, right? And here Korczak is being specifically childist. With his pedagogy is designed to elevate the status of children's knowledge and testimonials. So if I explain it in terms of Korczak's experience as a doctor, he says there's subjectivity on both the patient and the doctor relationship, on both sides. So if we think about that common situation that might happen when a patient's experience or knowledge about their own illness is judged by the doctor as less important than a medical professional, right? So often that defense that people come up with for ignoring or dismissing a patient is due to the difficulty and how time consuming it can get to try to get that description of an illness from them. Now, when you've got a patient who is emotionally stressed, is frightened, maybe they're in pain, really sick, maybe they've got a mental illness, or maybe they're very elderly, they're considered unreliable, right? Not taken seriously. Now, think about how adults describe their interactions with children, especially on serious matters. Right? There's no coincidence that they do not bother taking children's knowledge about themselves seriously for the same reasons and that unreliability, that lack of counterfactual information, and the problems that adults have with actually understanding what a child is trying to say. Because children struggle to understand their own experiences and express those significant and often bad things that happen to them. And then power relations make things worse when the adults ignore or discount their attempts to actually provide their account of what's happening to them. So Korczak claimed that both society and science, especially psychology, was robbing the children of the right to be themselves, that they were being belittled in comparison to adults, that it was making out the child to be less of a person, less human. You know, he says, of course, all grown-ups, we act mature all the time. You know, we're smart like professors and, you know, we're so clever all of the time. We're never a mess, are we? right? He tells us, he writes something down that I really like, where he says, the child is no more stupid than adults. And sometimes a wise child is stunned by the aggressive insecurity and offensive stupidity of adults and the way that society is run.
I can understand that point. And I think it seems easy to take this perspective with teenagers and older children. Okay, we can see them as sufficient, as competent as adults. But what about younger children or even babies? Are they also as subjects, they can gain their subjectivity in the face of adult beings?
Look, yeah, you're right, though. Often people want to pick out certain parts from Korchak, like they want to use model of the children's court, or they want to introduce voting as a type of democratic education for older children. And they neglect that his ideas apply to all age groups, to all people. Children are people, right? So this reflects how we are often trying to prepare children for participation in society instead of facilitating actual real participation, right? And it's this drawing of a line between older and younger children. It suggests that young children only have these kind of rights in the future. You know, they're becoming people with human rights. Now, that's usually because teenagers, like you said, they're closer to adults. They're considered to be more similar experiences and therefore more capable of informed and rational decision making than that small child or the baby. So remember that the emphasis on rationality, if we look through history, that was used to prevent women from voting. There was an argument that women were irrational and unstable, too emotional to be understood, to be able to make sort of these logical, rational decisions. So just as we've had citizenship and participation for women change over time, that political inclusion of children is gradually shifting also over time. So maybe I need to illustrate this concept of rationality again and shift us out of that developmental thinking about babies as not competent, as becoming people. So I'll use another example specifically about language learning because of that idea that adults find it really hard to understand small children and babies. So Piaget would often identify what he would call pre-logical linguistic mistakes of children. Okay. And he would look at these as intellectual deficits. He thought of them as proof that there was a lack of cognitive development. Instead, what Korchak does, we find him wanting to publish these kind of words and phrases and things that children were making, these errors. He wanted them out there for the wider public because he saw them as philosophical fragments, right? That they were revealing some kind of deeper truth about society, about culture, about reality, that certain sensitive children were able to access this kind of truth. So he gives the example of a toddler and her baby has taken her daddy has taken her to a farm to show her a cow. And he says to her, it says moo, it's called moo. And now the little child, she replies, Adamu, Adamu. And he laughs. He goes, no, it's just moo, silly baby. Right? Now, Ada was the little girl's dog's name. And the father was laughing because she put the dog's name Ada and the cow's name Moo together to say Adamu. But Korchak says to us, was she really wrong when the father mocked her, made fun of her mistake? Instead, he points out that this is actually a philosophical phenomena that's highlighting that the child's love is universal. She loves her dog and equally the cow, that she recognizes that there is an unseen union between all living creatures, and that maybe it's something that adults do not see or understand yet. So he finds such deep philosophical questions evident in children's minds. And this is a place where Piaget doesn't even go looking for them.
And now children beings are impressive, more impressive than adults here again. as we understand. And, you know, I agree with Korsak's perspective, because the child, as a little philosopher, finds a way, finds the connection between those animals, and she or he just develops some intimacy between animal and humans, we can say. So it's quite like the creative side of scientific thought. In philosophy, we can see that, and as little philosophers, children find all those connections in between. And I think maybe we question why Piaget has become the mainstream philosopher rather than psychologist, we can say, rather than Korsak. Korsak is not as well known as Piaget in the whole over the world. So it's quite interesting the difference of Korsak compared to other psychologists like Piaget and Vygotsky. And I think they were also interested in social and emotional development. Maybe you could tell us more about his approach, Korsak's approach, to the moral learning of children. What's the differences compared to Piaget's and Vygotsky's approach?
Well, particularly with Piaget, we find that Korsak will tell us that children are not amoral, that they're not unable of, sort of incapable of moral acting without adult guidance, that the child doesn't arrive blank and the child has character and childhood experiences that are giving meaning to that moral and social geography that she or he encounters. And that influences the way that they understand not only those situations, but actually language throughout life. You know, he points out that words like garden and father are not just good. They're not just good things, morally good, that they mean different things to different people. So if we remember how language and social interaction were to learning in every culture, if we take a look at fairy tales and children's stories, psychologists would like to tell us that we can pour the messages, you know, out of them about good and evil from the book. We just pour them into the child as if we're going to fill an empty bucket, or maybe we're going to write down what they think as if they're going to be a blank slate, a blank blackboard, and we're going to write on them, right? But Korsak is giving us some great examples. And one of them, he was reading a fairy tale. The fairy tale is the Little Red Riding Hood. And he's reading it to some five-year-olds. And now he's got to the part where the big bad wolf eats grandma, right? So you can see that imagery, the big and the bad wolf. And one child is so scared. And another child's really excited, like, what's happened next? What's happened next? One's really bored. They're just hungry. They're just looking out the window, right? And the last one jumps up and starts clapping and laughing and says, hooray, hooray, grandma's dead, right? Because they are so happy to get rid of somebody who is awful,
yeah,
and an awful person in their life. So you know, like, do we believe that there can be abusive people in people's families? So why do we read that the father, the mother, the grandmother are always good? Why do we treat these boundaries within children by believing that we're sending out some kind of moral message to children through stories? So what we do now with these different kind of differentiated experiences and meanings of certain words, we tend to take a word association. This is very much drawn from that psychoanalysis of childhood trauma. And we look again for that deficit, okay? Instead, Korsak took a philosophical approach that the child might actually have some deeper insight into their own experiences and even something deeper into the cultural context, that they're capable of analyzing the words, the story, through the language that they inhale. This is something they breathe subconsciously. So if we return to that childist perspective, he says that although reading the book is a shared experience, the process is going to be epistemologically different for the children than the adult. and we should be paying more attention to this.
And Basha, this this approach to the image of the child as a little philosopher, do you think it's something that it's unique to Polish culture, and that is why Kortak worked on that, or is it a more universal concept?
I think it may have emerged in a sense in Polish culture so strongly because this was a place, particularly in Kortak's time, where with many, many orphans. So you had many adults who were killed or disabled or died through illness during many revolutions and many wars and famines and so on. So children gained greater status and visibility within their society and were by necessity more capable perhaps in those roles that we don't necessarily imagine for children, of taking care of themselves and even perhaps younger children. But I also think, of course, it is universal. It's something that was discovered and revealed because children had this elevation, but it revealed something, some of this universal truth. Particularly, we could frame it in Polish philosophy, but also Eastern religion was very popular in Poland at the time because it ran with some of these converging ideas. For example, you can consider the Hindu idea that truth comes from our apprehension, that reality is merely an illusion. And that provides a similar basis for the image of the child that we talked about before with reality. So this is about the child's philosophical attempts to simultaneously reconcile their own place in the material world. But these are efforts that match our own, wherever and whenever that might be. Adults are often mistaking, elevating their own search, right, for these philosophical answers, but they mistake the children's searching questions as something silly. You know, this is amusing, this is fun, this is pretend play, or it's some kind of cute copying of mummy or daddy. But Kortak really explained it differently, and he puts it into such great words, and I'm going to give you one of these examples that he gives us. A little boy crawls on all fours and he barks because he needs to find out how animals can manage. He listens to a noise in a shell. He takes a magnifying glass to intensify the sun. He suggests playing doctor to a girl, hoping to see how she is made. He limps, he holds a stick, he pretends to be an old man, or maybe he's a soldier because he tests what it's like to be blind and he walks with his eyes closed. But now he lies down very still and he holds his breath. He wonders if that's what it's like to be dead. He winds the clock back in secret, breaking it, but he was checking if he can control time. He tortures a fly, pulling off its wings. Now, how's it going to fly? Anything that can be proven, he wants to see, to check, to experience for himself, to research. In the end, though, a great deal remains either a mystery, or he is just going to have to accept things on the say-so of adults without any proof at all if it is real or if it is true. So in one of his books about the baby, which he calls Bobo, the book is called Bobo and the baby is called Bobo, Kortak explains that the child is a speck of dust, a brother of everything. The substance of his soul is the same as the rest of the universe. Now, for me, when I hear that, if I spin my own thoughts about it, I hear this speck of dust reminding me of a famous children's book by Dr. Seuss. And it's called Horton Hears a Who, if you want to look it up. It was written in 1954. And there's this great, big, powerful elephant called Horton. And he hears a tiny noise coming from a speck of dust. And that sounds like a tiny person is making that noise. And Horton, the story keeps repeating its motto that a person's a person no matter how small, because Horton, the elephant, considers it his duty to protect this tiny speck. But he doesn't have any evidence, right, that there is person, a small person on this speck. Remember, just like Pasteur's bacteria, everybody is laughing and making fun of Horton because he believes that something exists, that there's an entire nation, a whole culture that's important on this speck. And so he's persecuted by the other animals. And then at the last minute, at the final hour, Horton is facing going to prison and the speck is about to be destroyed. And by cooperating together, the tiny people are able to make enough noise to prove their existence to the animal court. And they successfully get Horton freed, and he declares, I'm going to protect them no matter how smallish. Now, Korczak's speck of dust, the small baby, also needs the care, also needs our protection, as does that whole culture, all those specks of dust, the whole culture of childhood. But it's when the small people band together and cooperate to make noise, that in that collective, they force us to notice and care about their existence. And that's where I think I'll end this comparison with Dr. Seuss.
So I think that all this is also related to something else. And we have already discussed this with you, but we have listened to you talking about preternatural pedagogy. Is that right? I can't even pronounce it.
Yeah. Well, that's because I made it up. Yeah. No, it's my pedagogical concept, which I take from the Latin word praeter, which means something which appears outside or beyond. So if you put that with natural, it means seeking that which is buried or next to what is dominant, what is the norm or natural. So preternatural is the idea of something between the natural and the supernatural, okay? So think about all that we've talked about. We've got the natural world, the child of nature, Rousseau's innocent, you know, which could be explained in terms of natural sciences as the human animal. But then we've also talked a bit about this kind of metaphysical idea towards the supernatural, that magical thinking of a world that we lived in long ago, which many of us still inhabit today. You know, it was the spirits of our ancestors, unseen forces, the prayers to the gods. So what I think is, and this I think might be really helpful for someone like you, Saran, who does not necessarily have a faith or such beliefs. But with my pedagogy, I'm proposing not taking them on, but blurring the boundary, blurring that between the natural and what we know and the supernatural of what we don't know. And it's between what we can explain and that divine or that mysterious and that spiritual. And I consider that the child is the link, that they are connected to something more than natural and something beyond us. They have a closer link to something divine, to our ancestors, to something related to the prophets. And preternatural pedagogy is a re-enchantment. We're seeking something else. We're transgressing. We're even destroying this old order. And that is because there's potential to reveal what is hidden. And maybe we can imagine something that is at the moment impossible, and actually create something new and hopefully better.
It sounds like quite impressive. And while listening to you, I also connected these ideas to the tension between intuition and intellect, as we talked in the beginning. But what does that look like for us to make it more concrete in a group of children in a classroom? Does that pedagogy offer us an approach more individualistic or collectivist? Do you think, is there any difference like that?
Right, well, here I'll have to flip education right around. I have to reverse it completely. And I have to ask, what can the child show us about the world? So I'm talking, like we've got in the title of this episode, about educating the educator. What do children show me about truth, love, justice, creativity? And it's quite different to the way many teachers are socialized into this psychological view of children as still developing into people. You know, usually if we look at how we view education, the teacher has to assess and defend the outcomes of the children, how the child turned out, to society, to others in society, how the child is turning out. Now, what I'm proposing is flipping it around. I'm saying that now the child is the judge, and that we say that the teachers, we have to defend how society is turning out. I mean, we've been here for a while as adults. What have we done about it? The way that society is, what are we questioning? What are we changing? And this really reverses the way we can think about education. And like I said before, it's the child who doesn't just rearrange my furniture, you know, that material world, but also rearranges my values, gives me that experience, affects my worldview from taking that shift of standing in a different part of the universe with the child. So I'm not taking psychological observations in my work with children. I still, you know, I take a lot of those kind of things that other teachers might, but it's very much philosophical ones, how the world is and how it might be in an ethical sense. I look at the different roles and the relationships between children and adults and the social and natural environment, but also that subjectivity from within myself. So it's not a philosophy about childhood or children. It's a philosophy from children about what it means to be human. And Praita Natural Pedagogy is about creating the space in ourselves, in our own attitude and behavior, to see the world in a new way. And it's this concept that the small, remember that's the speck, you know, the micro mirrors the macro. I mean, that appears in a lot of philosophical thought. And contemporary educators, like we said, like to describe young children as scientists, you know, exploring with empirical curiosity through the sensory perception. But this is a real positivist viewpoint, void of any metaphysics. And that's what we're doing at Copernica Education. We're trying to bring together that scientific hypothesis that so many people use with empirical analysis. We want to tie that back to cultural knowledge and this inner wisdom. And okay, there are a few pedagogical programs like this now. We do have some examples from Lippmann, for example, philosophy with children, philosophy for children. But these are still approaches that are trying to teach philosophy to children. They are drawing out philosophical questions in children's books. It's like the epistemological questions that I already was talking to you about in Dr. Seuss. But they already think they have the philosophical answers ready, right? So the adults are in charge of the process. They, in effect, are guiding this philosophical inquiring, seeing how far children get, assessing them, not expecting anything new. Whereas for us, we're saying the child is the philosopher, constantly asking questions about reality, the nature of human knowledge, and so on and so on, right? So when I look at Korczak's books, for example, How to Love a Child, they're written in the form of these meditations or exercises for the adult to undertake, to reflect, to learn and grow. And I use the books as the course material for the parents, the teachers, other professionals to extend themselves into understanding that transcendental language of the philosopher child that's right in front of us. Right? They're speaking to us in this language of facial messages, images, emotions. So let's forget the idea of the child as an innocent or the child as a natural animal. Let's replace them with this image of a philosopher poet. And I want you to picture the child arriving like a stranger in a foreign land. And it's up to us to learn their language and learn to understand their viewpoint of us. So in our definition, preternatural pedagogy is not the study of the child or education, but actually it's the study of what it is to be human. And I suppose I'm hinting that in our study lies the key for more human understanding, for more freedom and more flourishing.
And you know, this is great, Basha. Yeah, it's fantastic.
He just came from the nature of I think so. And I'm thinking that we were talking about the nature of the child, and now we are talking about the image of philosopher poets as children as philosopher poets. So it's quite impressive for me. And I think there is too much to think about so far regarding your book, The Experience of Our Home, which is a very crucial example. And I'm quite eager to talk about your book and your process of writing that. And maybe we need another episode to talk about all this. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, it's a fairly complex philosophy of education, and I suppose philosophy of life. It's a game that I play, and maybe we can leave this here for now and talk a little bit next time. What about if we do delve a little bit more into that ideas around democracy and community building, and get a little bit more political, and we can have a session on the kingdom is a game, and we can continue this discussion specifically on relating Korczak ideas to democracy and children's rights and basically his political theories. What do you think?
I think that is great, and I think our audience would love that too.
So thank you.
Please join us next time when we are going to discuss more interesting ideas with Basha Busit on The Kingdom is a Game. Thank you, Basha. Thank you, Saran.
Thank you so much.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.